Good evening, listeners. You are listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine. This is Josh Mitchell, and I'm your host for the evening. On this week's show, we're going to explore the virus that brings dread to all medical professionals, Ebola. One of the scariest viruses we know on the planet, the Ebola virus has been quietly smoldering in Africa for the past 40 recorded years. And now, it's finally starting to flare up. So tonight, we're going to talk about Ebola, the past, the present, and the future as well. I'm joined by two fellow colleagues, Ariel Clark and a longtime PNM host, Kelly Schwartz. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks, Josh. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, great to be here.
All right, so let's dive in, starting off with, so Ebola, it's a virus.
What is a virus, Josh? What do viruses do? Those are like bacteria, right?
In some ways, they're a little bit like bacteria, except, you know, viruses are kind of funny because we don't necessarily look at them as being necessarily as alive as bacteria, right? And so bacteria have their own unique little cell, whereas viruses are kind of hijacking things. You can almost think of them as like small parasites for individual cells.
Okay.
All right, would you go along with that?
Yes. Sorry, I was distracted by a quick mic change.
So you mentioned cells. So it sounds like they like certain cell types, but not other cell types.
Yeah, you get that. And actually, Ari, how well do you know about Ebola and cell types here?
So actually, a little bit, I would say.
Good.
Ebola tends to infect primarily at the beginning of an infection macrophages and dendritic cells, which are cells that are really important for your immune system. And Ebola is actually not really necessarily interacting at the cell surface to enter cells, but is rather taken up by being engulfed by the cell. So like your immune cells, like macrophages, tend to eat
They're eating cells. So phage means
yes.
Eat.
I love that. Yeah. Eating cells.
Eating cells. Yeah. You've got the white eating cells and you've got the big macro eating cells, right?
So exactly.
So they engulf them as opposed to the virus kind of docking on the outside and transporting in that way.
Right. And so it's actually transported to the lysosome, which is like the trash compactor of the cell or the garbage disposal, where Ebola then has to escape in order to replicate itself in the cell cytoplasm.
Which is just the goo in between all the organelles. Okay.
Exactly, yeah. So even, you know, Ebola in itself, right? So it's a virus. But I think one of the good focuses to move forward with, too, is that it's typically what we would consider in some ways more of like a tropical disease.
Ooh. So I love tropical diseases. I love tropical drinks, tropical diseases. What is a tropical disease? That sounds nice and refreshing.
Refreshing is a word for it, isn't it? So tropical diseases are typically diseases you're going to find that more, I would say, between, what is it, we call it Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn.
In the tropics.
Classic.
I love those Henry Miller books.
Yeah, exactly. So we're talking kind of your warm weather diseases, which is a little bit terrifying. You know, we can touch on that later with a little bit of like global climate change, where that's starting to expand, but you know, typically very specific range that you see these diseases. So Ebola is not something that you would find you don't really see it in the Americas in general, north, south at all. It's typically been isolated to Africa is where you see outbreaks, and a couple of times in labs as well.
Well, yeah, but specifically, I think none of the outbreaks have ever erupted anywhere outside of the Democratic Republic of Congo, so that's actually probably the source of most of these outbreaks, or like the place where whatever is the reservoir of this virus is the most common. And I think one of the reasons we should talk about why these are tropical diseases and not North American diseases is because the tropics have such a huge wealth of ecological diversity, and Ebola, as well as some other tropical diseases that we like to talk about in the news, are coming from that ecological diversity. So these are all zoonotic diseases, which means that they've crossed over from animals, crossed the species barrier, and are now infecting humans.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great examples. So one that we'd definitely be familiar with, at least, you know, and even in the Midwest really well, is Lyme disease. So, you know, ticks.
Ooh, hiss. Don't like Lyme disease.
Which is unfortunately only getting worse in the Midwest. So, you know, that's one of the major concerns, right? It's getting a little warmer. Ticks are moving further north when typically it was cooler. So we didn't run into that problem.
And there's also hot spots too, right? Because because if you were to just travel on a parallel into Michigan, my home state, greatest state in the union, if you ask me, there's not as high of an incidence of Lyme disease. in that area. So it's one of these things where it's kind of rapidly changing too. Like Madison, Wisconsin has become a real hotspot for Lyme disease. So it's something that we really need to study and kind of learn. And again, as you say, climate change is affecting the spread of these diseases. We need to stay on top of them, which is why I think, something like Ebola is really interesting, is because even though it's not here now, who knows?
That's the scary part. Would you agree, Ari?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so this outbreak had been kind of isolated to the DRC or the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but has recently passed the line into Uganda and is getting closer and closer to these major epicenters or huge populations that could potentially lead to this outbreak leaking outside of Africa even.
And this is the most current outbreak that you're talking about right now. Do you know when this started? I've heard a lot about it in the news in the last few weeks, and that kind of coincides with the World Health Organization sort of declaring this like something to be concerned about, right?
Yeah. So that's the big news piece, right? Is that if anybody's watching their infectious disease news, you know, the big news is the WHO, not the band, but the World Health Organization just recently released, or I should say classified, this Ebola outbreak as a PHEIC. And so that's PHEIC. And that is a possible health emergency of international concern. So
that sounds scary.
It is kind of scary. And so jumps back a couple of years, but there was another huge outbreak like this. That was even larger, 2013 to 2016. Mm-hmm. So this most current one actually started a year ago. It started in 2018. So far, we're looking at, it's just shy of 3,000 people who are infected. And I think right now they're talking about deaths at about 1,700. So we're talking a 61% fatality rate right now, which is really terrifying. And this is also what makes it such a big deal. Yeah. Are you want to touch on that too?
So
I'm also curious to know real quick, when did Ebola kind of emerge as a disease of interest to the West?
Ooh, to the West.
Or just in general, like when did we discover Ebola?
Yeah, so Ebola was, this is a harder one. I know that kind of major recognition of Ebola happened actually in the 70s, around 76, and it was actually in the Sudan is where it started off with.
Oh, okay.
And so we've known about Ebola, really, for about the last just over 40 recorded years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened a lot. These are usually small outbreaks also. That's been the interesting thing. So it's really only been these last two major events that have been in some ways globally concerning. Typically, which not to say it's good, but usually the number of people involved in these outbreaks was less than 300 or around 300.
Okay.
And even still, case fatality rate, right? The amount of people that died really hung at the low end, maybe 25%, high end.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So it's absolutely brutal. So in the high end, we're talking 90%. So it was absolutely terrifying when it breaks out, but it was typically so small. So it was never like this huge dramatic event where it's like, oh my gosh, thousands of people. It's a couple hundred.
Right. And these, I think the early outbreaks, if I'm not mistaken, were usually in more rural parts of the country and not necessarily in these big urban epicenters where transmission can be rapidly increased.
That was just an interesting part. And to give it context, right, I think probably one of the biggest things that we're familiar with, if it's fair to say, is going to be 1918 Spanish flu, right? We had the big flu epidemic.
My favorite flu epidemic.
Well, it's the greatest flu epidemic.
The greatest flu epidemic ever to kill thousands of people.
Well, it was millions of people.
Millions of people.
So I'm trying to remember what they say. The estimate is absolutely brutal. So, 1918, we have Spanish flu, as nobody remembers nowadays, because I doubt there's as many listeners that are approaching that 100-year-old point of being born.
Shout out to our P&M listeners approaching the centurion. Thank you for tuning in. We love you.
we appreciate it.
Yes.
Yeah, so they talked about half a billion people were infected in the 1918 influenza pandemic, the Spanish flu. Poor Spain, they always get the bad rap for that. So, you have 500 million people, right? And the deaths totaled 50 to 100 million people. Now, at the time, you think about that. So they roughly said it's between 3 to 5% of the population, or 3 to 5% of the people that acquired the infection ended up dying. And so, Spanish flu, absolutely terrifying in that case. Mm-hmm. You look at Ebola, you know, fatality rates across all of these different events and all these different outbreaks, and we're talking on the low end, 25%. We're talking on the high end, 90%. Mm-hmm. So the potential to be catastrophic, oh yeah, it's way up there.
So let me ask you this. I think that when people think of Ebola, we think of it being as a hemorrhagic fever. Hemorrhagic meaning blood. Mm-hmm. And I know, without getting too gruesome with the details, what is Ebola characterized by? Can you tell us a little bit about how it's diagnosed and sort of how that contributes to treatment or to the spread of the disease?
Yeah, so I'm not really super familiar with the diagnostics. I assume that there's some kind of there should be a test to detect viral DNA, probably. Mm-hmm. Is what I'm assuming,
or like an antigen or something. Yeah. Like that. Mm-hmm. Test.
But what a hemorrhagic fever is basically it induces hemorrhaging, so like bleeding and bruising. And something that happens during an Ebola infection is that kind of the cells that are important for keeping your body's fluids where they're supposed to be are being damaged. Mm-hmm. Clotting proteins that induce blood clotting are decreased. And so you kind of just get fluid leakage between tissues. Eey. Out of the yeah. liver and the spleen and the kidneys.
Yeah, so your body's kind of being like digested almost from the inside. That's no good.
No.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. And you know, people do actually survive this, but that is also one of the things they talk about. Survivors do not necessarily like return back to a normal baseline. It is mm-hmm. a brutal thing. And mm-hmm. I mean, people who survive are so fortunate. It is miraculous. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, this shreds you. It is brutal. I highly suggest do not look at pictures. Like, this is not something you want to, it's not a game you want to enter. It's not pleasant. Yeah.
Yes.
But it is absolutely fascinating.
So this is what. So unlike the Spanish flu, which killed a lot of people, this one is very gruesome, has a very high mortality rate, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem like it spreads quite as well. How is it spread?
So Ebola can only really spread by contact with bodily fluids, kind of similar, you can think of, to HIV transmission.
Okay.
And actually, Ebola, we've come to find out, can also be sexually transmitted.
Uh-oh.
But yeah, basically, the main route of transmission is through like contact with blood or spit from someone who is infected or an infected animal. So as long as people take the proper precautions, like wearing gloves and face masks, mm-hmm. And not handling dead animals that they're finding like in the forest,
sure,
they should be all right. Whereas something like the flu can be aerosolized, mm-hmm. and is much more easily transmitted like through the air.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at it, that's one of the huge differences, right? When we talk, you know, once again, going back to the Spanish flu, 500 million people in Ebola, typically the biggest infection case that we had, 2013 to 2016, just shy of 30,000 people is what they thought were the predicted amount of people that were infected. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, it's brutal because of what they say is about 30,000 people, 11,000 people died from that.
Yeah.
And so the actual recorded number, so the 28,000 is the estimation. Of the people they knew who had it and died, it was 70% fatality rate.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a absolutely gruesome thing, but just terrifying to track, but really important to know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, where do we want to go from here? What do we learn, Ari? What do we learn from these outbreaks?
I would say that we've learned a lot about how to handle outbreaks, mm-hmm. especially in developing countries. So the Ebola outbreak and health workers from outside of Africa coming into the country to try to help the locals learn about Ebola and how to deal with it and prevent its spread have encountered like a lot of roadblocks. So one issue is that in the DRC, they're undergoing some conflict, like civil war type conflict. Mm-hmm. And so there's been health centers that have been closed due to violence. There's been a lot of mistrust from local communities. And so basically, health workers have had to learn how to meet locals at their own level, mm-hmm. and to not only distribute information, but also to listen to their concerns and try to incorporate their problems and their concerns and their thoughts into their approach.
Mm-hmm.
From a science perspective, we haven't moved as far And one of the big reasons is that we have to handle Ebola in a biosafety level 4 lab, which is like what you think of on your like medical horror TV show, like the hazmat suit, the big hose, like huge gloves and like decontamination. And those labs are really expensive to run. They're dangerous and they're just not very common.
Because there's only, I think, like, I want to say 2, maybe 3 in the United States.
Yeah. I believe you're right.
It's a very small amount.
At the, both of the CDC centers.
Yeah.
And maybe one other place.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a medical facility. There's, I was going to say, it's like an Army Research Center, I think, has one too.
Oh, so Red, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's absolutely incredibly dangerous to work with and time consuming, you know. When when you talk BSL level 4, it's, I got to say, there are some, I highly suggest, this is the one I do suggest, look at what people, scientists have to go through to get into these high-level labs. Because, I mean, it's not as, it's not your, that's the movie I was looking for. It's not your Resident Evil lab where it's like zombies and things running around, right? You don't have to worry about that. You know,
I mean,
it's not
how
flickering
would we
lights.
Know?
Exactly. We don't have flickering lights. It's it's very routine. But it can take upwards of an hour or two to prepare to get in. Like, you have to inspect the suit. Like I said, watch the video. It's a little bit boring, but informative. Informative's the key part here. And, I mean, you have to prep for a long time. You got to make sure there's no air holes, because a lot of the outbreaks that ended up happening, which is really interesting too, is that there's a whole list of outbreaks that happen kind of, I don't know, in the wild, I suppose, in real life, so to speak. But there's also a lot of lab outbreaks. And a lot of those lab outbreaks, you know, just usually a handful of people, maybe two people that are in a lab and get exposed. And those typically are not usually deadly, usually because they're minor or single cases, as they're kind of characterized. They've happened in the United States. They've happened in, I want to say, Germany maybe had some. Russia's had that with laboratory contamination. So, like, people have to be really cautious, because a single needle stick could be the end for you.
Oh, yeah. That is actually surprising. That's, I feel like, one aspect of this story that I haven't heard about, which is, like, the prevalence of lab accidents that have resulted in active Ebola infections, like, elsewhere in the lab. I think I do remember hearing about the United States one, but not in Germany or Russia. That's scary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is. Because, you know, a lot of different places are looking to study Ebola. I mean, it's hugely interesting because it's terrifying and it's really informative.
So let me ask you this. When life hands you lemons, you make lemonade. There's got to be a treatment out there for this. So it seems like if you can actually develop a treatment to prevent this, or even more greedily scientist thinking, if you can find a way to take this mechanism that the virus has used to sort of hijack cells and then create some kind of a useful IP or intellectual property idea based on that, there's got to be some money to be made in this, right? So how can we treat this and how can we use this technology kind of going forward?
Yeah, so like right now there isn't a really great treatment other than like palliative care techniques. So like we give fluids and oxygen and electrolytes, and then we have to, you know, treat the fever, treat the vomiting, like whatever the symptoms are. There is a vaccine out there that's currently being tested. It's not FDA approved yet, but it is being used in Africa to try to and in the Congo to try to stem the spread of the outbreak. It's called RSV. Oh man.
Is it the Zbov one?
Zbov,
yeah.
And it's reported to have almost 100% effectiveness.
Oh wow.
Unfortunately, delivering the vaccine, getting people to be willing to receive the vaccine, has been a hard thing to do. And also, recently the health minister in the DRC banned its use. There's since been a new health minister put in place, and he's expected to lift that ban. But right now, I think they're not allowed to use this vaccine.
And is it just this one vaccine, or does this include other like Western medicines or treatments that, you know, health workers are trying to provide?
I believe this is the main one.
This is the main one?
Yeah, this is the main one. This is the one that's made it the farthest. So there's a couple of vaccines they're looking in, but this is the one that, it's an interesting case, because this is the one that they said, this is the furthest along. You know, we don't really know if this actually works as effectively. We have no idea. And they said, you know, this is more of like an act of goodness. Let's use it, because really bad comes to worse. Even if it has no protection, at least you gave it. You know, worst case scenario is nothing happens. Best case scenario, you save thousands of lives. And so far, that's how they've used it. And, you know, this actually leads into a great social commentary that I think Ari and Kevin, our sound guy, we're really looking forward to. Sound engineer. Sorry. Sorry, Kevin. So
he's got a degree, you know.
I know. Sorry, Kevin.
He's got letters behind his name.
That's okay.
Okay. Thank you for that. So talking about social implications, I think this is actually a great idea because, or a great touching point, because one of the concerns too about the vaccine is that you're giving these vaccines to people that really hardly have any idea of what's going on. And so we're still talking about really rural, uneducated areas of the globe where a lot of these outbreaks are happening. Ari, you want to touch on this more?
I mean, I think we've talked about it a little bit, but it's about having to come meet these communities at their level, realize what's important to them and what they think about the world around them, and use that to your advantage when you want to do things like deliver vaccines, or at least, or even just discuss, like, what is this disease? Why is it hurting the people that you love? And how are we going to stop it?
Well, also not to infantilize them, to say that they couldn't possibly understand the complexities that we understand, right? To figure out sort of what it is that's important to them, because there's a lot of things that we could miss, you know, especially as scientists, you know, like we are stuck in kind of one point of view. We don't have that field knowledge, you know, that these people would. So it's important to keep an open dialogue, I think, about that too.
Yeah, Kevin, you had something to say here, didn't you?
So I mean, I think that's sort of the basis of a lot of outreach efforts right now. What you said, Kelly, is sort of understanding the cultural context and sort of putting aside this sort of the academics, capital A, called the knowledge deficit model, where, you know, people are just deficient of information, and if we just give it to them, it'll be fine. I've studied a little bit of there's some outreach in Burkina Faso around family planning, which is a highly stigmatized subject, even potentially more than Ebola, of course, and vaccines. But of course, the Ebola and vaccines have become stigmatized. I'm curious what the narrative around that is, but put that aside for a second. Even if my big concern is, even if, like, perfect outreach, you know, you go into every single area, every single village, every single town, and you find out how they're phrasing this, what's the cultural context of this issue, where does the distrust lie? Is it just outsiders? Is it the vaccine? Is it injecting something? And then get local folks to sort of talk about this to their neighbors and, you know, do all the things right. My big concern is, at some point, there's an intersection between the local community and outsiders trying to bring this vaccine in, because, I mean, obviously it's not coming from the DRC. So if it gets to the point of outsiders be gone, wins the day, you know, at what point do scientists have to just dig their heels in, or medical administrators have to dig their heels in and say, like, no, this is really good, and I know you don't trust me, but I kind of have to do this.
Yeah, that I think is really great point. And I think something that is really interesting is just looking at the Western world response. So in the 2013 to 2016 outbreak, there was an American nurse that was infected, and she was brought back to the United States, and people lost their minds because, I mean, you had people on both sides of the argument, which is a tough thing, and I get it. I mean, it's terrifying to think that, you know, you look at Ebola, right? What we talked about, you talk about, you know, typically more than 50% of people that get it end up dying. And you just introduced, is this patient zero that you always worry about that just came back to the United States, right? And so it was wild.
They lost their minds over the fact that it was suddenly in our backyard, you mean, the Americans?
Exactly, yeah. You know, it's in our backyard. What do we do? Like, our response. And it's a crazy thing to think about that, you know, how would, you know, the United States respond if a pocket of Ebola popped up in, I don't know, let's say Kansas. I don't know why Kansas, but Kansas, right? You know, how would we respond? Would we be the same calm people we like to think of ourselves are that listen to science? Or would we also be terrified and just totally collapse? You know, it's an interesting question because, you know, we have all this knowledge, but how do we respond to that when it's, you know, in our backyard?
And how do we respond to the inherent racism of this being a disease? Yeah, of Africa too. I mean, it's there's more than a little latent racism in a lot of these tropical, and that's another good reason to talk about why tropical diseases are important and relevant to the West.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to comment on that public outcry when we brought that person back to the United States, and I think that kind of reaction is very indicative of the kind of social problems and the tones of racism that surround this whole issue, is that a lot of people didn't care or think about the Ebola outbreak when it was in the DRC, when it was in Africa. Yeah. And then when we brought one of our own, so to speak, back, and it was on our soil, and now we were actually directly threatened, then it was a problem and we wanted to talk about it and be scared about it and inflammatory.
And it's not entirely dissimilar from what had happened with HIV as well, when it was an out-group problem. But then once it started affecting, straight white people, all of a sudden,
very good point.
That's when it got a lot of attention. But, and it shouldn't have gotten to that point. It's something where it was definitely something that was a great disrespect and something we should learn from moving forward with these kinds of disease treatments and how we view them.
Yeah. I mean, you can apply the same thing, which is in many ways amazing, right? Smallpox. Smallpox is eradicated globally outside of a couple of vials that are hidden away in labs, right? Smallpox is gone. Polio largely was going that way too. There was, unfortunately, kind of what we talked about, some unfortunate social implications that popped up that led to a resurgence of polio in the Middle East. But same thing, when polio, the March for Dimes, an absolute classic, iron lung. Are you doing okay there, Kelly? March for Dimes really got you, didn't it?
Yeah, a classic.
A classic.
I've given them so many dimes. I love their mints.
Yeah. But it's amazing, right? Yeah. Everybody in the United States took part to eradicate polio, in the United States. We have changed the vaccine. So, the original vaccine was it? Was it attenuated, Ari? Is that the right term, right? So I think it was live attenuated, right? So it could actually flare up and give somebody polio, but by far and large, it didn't. It was, I don't know, 1 in 5 million chance. Mm-hmm. We've stopped giving that polio vaccine in the United States because the rate of getting polio was so low, we were giving it to ourselves in vaccines. And now, there is not polio in the United States that actually originates from people with polio. It doesn't happen, right? And so it is, you do see those inherent stereotypes and concerns that pop up when it's on domestic soil, we're terrified. But the moment it's away from it, even though it's really a plane ride away, why do we care?
And that's something that we'll have to kind of think about in considering disease treatments and educating ourselves too, and about, we have this sort of, I don't know, sternness to us that we think that we can solve the world's problems without listening to kind of the greater knowledge of the world talking back to us. So,
yeah, so I think, that's going to give us a lot to look forward to in the future and look forward to in both ways, right? Both sayings of that, both in terror and joy, because, where we have global climate change, perhaps global warming, right? Mm-hmm. We're seeing tropical diseases, Zika, something that was typically more in warmer South America is creeping up in the United States. So,
dengue is coming.
Could we have Ebola start coming in the United States? I mean, hopefully not, but could happen. Mm-hmm. So, that's going to be something we need to consider moving forward. So,
but in the meantime, I hope our listeners don't worry too much, but educate yourself and think about how this disease exists in the context of the globe, how it relates to you, how it relates to people that are in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Yeah. So, thank you, Ari. Thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate it.
This is fun.
No problem.
Yeah. So, that concludes this week's broadcast of PNM. So, thank you for everyone for joining us tonight. This show was hosted by me, Josh Mitchell. And as I said, thank you to our discussion panelists, Kelly Schwartz and Ariel Clark. And a special thank you to our PNM engineer, Kevin Lauryoung. So, tune in for next week's Perpetual Notion Machine. Facing beta, blasting through the night.